Recording of Leon Pearson's broadcast, Sunday, July the 12th, 1953.
75 degrees. NBC presents Critic at Large. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you the transcribed observations of a roving critic, Leon Pearson. Mr. Pearson's assignment has taken him to New England, where through the facilities of station WBZ Boston, he reports today on Marlon Brando in the Summer Theater, John Foster Dulles, Wired for Sound, and Modern New England Witchcraft in the Form of the Dowsing Rod. For this intriguing report, here is Leon Pearson.
During the past few days at Ogunquit, Maine and Matunuck, Rhode Island, I saw a Summer's Theater, which is no longer kids in blue jeans. It's professional, high class, and expensive. Ogunquit was playing Affairs of State with Betty Furness. Matunuck was playing Arms and the Man with Marlon Brando. Good business in both places, but the managers both testified they had to take in as much as $6,000 or $8,000 a week to break even. Don Wolin at Matunuck, that's the theater by the sea, raised his prices for the week to $420 top to meet the cost of Brando, which is $5,000 for the package of 8 actors. That's expensive theater. But the house was packed. The stars draw crowds, no doubt about it. There were stars all over the place at Matunuck. Stars on the stage, stars in the audience, stars rehearsing on the beach. While Brando was playing, Carol Channing was rehearsing the next bill. I passed Carol Channing and she opened her big eyes and said, "Give my love to Nicole." In the audience, between the acts, people were passing programs around to get autographs from other members of the audience. Might have been a benefit night on Broadway. No, this is not a bunch of kids with paint buckets making theater in an old barn. The Brando performance was excellent, but what struck me was that he chose to play Sergius instead of Bluntschli. In Arms and the Man, the lead is Bluntschli, the fugitive soldier, you remember, who climbs to the balcony of the lady's bedchamber to escape with his life. But Brando plays the buffoon Bulgarian Sergius. In fact, he switched roles during the rehearsals. After the show, I asked him why. He said he thought it was an interesting part to develop. Well, it was, and he developed it beautifully. But he had to forego the fatter part, handed it over to William Redfield, the part that Shaw put himself into and put his own wit into. Brando told me this in the refreshment room adjoining the theater. He had been sitting with other members of the cast, Redfield and Ann Kimball, and Sam Gilman. He wore a t-shirt and a yachting cap. When he got up to talk to me, he held the cap behind him in his hands. We talked about the play and also about Europe. He's going to Europe next month. It's an escape, he said, from the crass commercialism of Broadway and Hollywood. In Europe, he said, there's less money but more art. Even a street cleaner knows something about painting. Then suddenly, this actor, Brando, looked up at the roof, looked down at his cap, turned and flung his cap in the face of Billy Redfield. It was wet and it splashed all over Redfield. While Brando was talking to me, his fellow actors had poured beer into his yachting cap, probably in return for something he'd done to them. Horseplay. He's just a boy, and this was summer stock in the theater by the sea. High-class acting followed by horseplay. Two other summer managers were there that night to see Brando, Jim Orr of Falmouth and Milton Stiefel of Ivorytown, Connecticut. There's a close cooperation among a number of them, Orr and Mooney on the Cape, Lane at Ogunquit, Wolin at Matunuck, Lee Falk in Boston, and so on. I'll have more to say about this next week. One evening some years ago, I went to call on John Foster Dulles at his hotel suite in Moscow. He was a member of the U.S. delegation to the Big Four Conference. I, as a journalist, was looking for some background information. Dulles was normally very helpful that way. But on this occasion, he seemed strangely cautious. I put out a number of feelers, got no response. Presently, Dulles got up, moved his chair into the center of the room, and motioned for me to do the same. Then he said, "I think we'll do better away from the wall. This room is wired for sound." From that point on, he was more communicative. Today, Mr. Dulles is our Secretary of State, and there is some evidence that his own department is wired for sound. This is amazing if true. In the Reporter magazine, the current issue, Theodore Kagan tells the story of his own purge from the job in Public Affairs, U.S. High Commission, Germany. When he returned to Washington to appear before the McCarthy Committee, He found the State Department in a mood of fear. He says, one State Department official, a well-placed man with long years of experience, came to see me between hearings, telling me that he had advice on how to handle my problem. I said I was ready to listen to anybody's good advice, but couldn't promise to take it. My would-be advisor then picked up a pencil and wrote on a pad, let's get out of here. This place is wired. So they took a walk around the block. This and a great deal more about the purgers and the purged appears in The Reporter. I wonder if Mr. Dulles in Washington ever has occasion to pick up his chair and move it into the middle of the room. The August issue of Esquire is just out and allowed me to bump into my old friend Ernie Leiser again. The last time I bumped into Ernie was in Frankfurt at the U.S. Press Club, where life for American correspondents was only a little less plush than at the Press Club in Berlin. Incidentally, I've just heard from Lieutenant Herb Kirk, the U.S. Information Officer, that the Berlin Press Club, with its bar and its barber service and its tennis courts, has been returned to the German owners, and the club as such exists no more. But the army of occupation goes marching on toward the perfect welfare state. That's what Ernie Leiser writes about, a delightful piece which goes to show that those ultra-conservative types, our military officers, have unwittingly set up for themselves in Germany a socialized existence with all of man's needs and all the wife's needs too, especially if she is expectant, taken care of by a benevolent government. This welfare state, says Leiser, extends from the cradle to the grave, or at least to the military mortuary. That's Utopia the Army Way in the August Esquire. Another expert on Germany, our recent High Commissioner, John J. McCloy, writes more soberly of the whole problem of U.S. foreign policy in a new book just published by Harvard University Press under the title The Challenge to American Foreign Policy. This little volume, which you can read in an hour or two, is full of meat, but it does not say what I think some U.S. authority should speak up and say, that we are not going to get a European army with German contingents in it. More than a year ago in Bonn, I asked McCloy when he thought the treaty would be ratified, and he said in about 6 months. Well, he was wrong then, and he and Dulles and all the others are still wrong. Neither the French nor the Germans are going to allow Western German rearmament in the present sweep toward total German unification. In my New England sojourns, I have come very close to the residence of Kenneth Roberts, the famous novelist, that is, Kennebunkport, Maine. Remember Northwest Passage and Arundel? Mr. Roberts is still there, still writing. In fact, his latest book was published just last week, The Seventh Sense. But this is not a sequel to his historical romances. It's a sequel to Henry Gross and his dowsing rod. It is further evidence to prove that water, fresh, flowing water, can be located underground by the use of a forked stick in the hands of a man who has this seventh sense. Such a man is Henry Gross, whose technique is explained by Mr. Roberts as follows. In hunting for a vein or a dome, when standing in the center or on the edge of a given piece of land, he raises his rod and asks, either silently or aloud, where is the nearest vein of water from the spot on which I stand? He then turns slowly with his rod poised before him. When the rod turns violently forward and downward, he's facing the nearest spot of the nearest vein. I ask you, what kind of witchcraft is this? I thought we hanged those Salem witches 300 years ago. But here is an occult science practiced in the 20th century, vigorously defended and developed by one of our most reputable authors, Mr. Roberts, in a book published by Doubleday. But the dowsing is even more magical than that. Henry Gross, says Mr. Roberts, can locate water in a distant place without even going there. All he needs is a map. Roberts writes, when Henry douses a map or a sketch of a piece of land from a distance, the operation is essentially the same, except that the map or the sketch is laid flat on the floor or on the table. The talented Mr. Gross passes his rod over the map, marks the spot where the rod dips, and sends a letter or a telegram to the owner of the land telling him where to drill, all this without leaving Kennebunkport, Maine. I recommend this book, The Seventh Sense, for light summer reading. Of course, I don't guarantee that you won't become a convert. The evidence is very persuasive. All the wells they have dug and all the relief they have brought with the company called Water Unlimited, which is nothing more than the incorporation of this modest downeaster with his magic stick of wood. It could be even more persuasive if Mr. Roberts weren't so mad at everybody. He has a sort of quixotic vexation with the skeptics. We're all out of step but him and Henry. He's especially mad at the geologists and the engineers who say the dowsing rod is wholly fantastic and unexplainable. I know, he says, that it is fantastic and unexplainable, but I also know that it exists and can no longer be ignored and wasted. During 1950 and 51 and 52, he says, I saw it in operation thousands of times and used it on my own farm to drain and clear land that had baffled farmers for generations. Here is a very interesting point. Do we need to have a scientific explanation for everything we accept? If so, there would be no faith, for faith is the acceptance of things we cannot see. This is Robert's point. He wants his man Gross to be made useful to a world thirsty for water, whether he can be explained or not. Robert says, nobody has ever put a star in a laboratory, but the stars still shine. In moving about New England, I have derived a great deal of assistance from a little handbook on motoring, which is not approved by the AAA, entitled The Half-Open Road. No glove compartment should be without this maniac motoring manual. Keith Jennison is the author, Doubleday the publisher, and it says, it is important to realize at the outset that the function of the car ahead is to be passed. That is what it is there for. And if you feel you must make hand signals, the most important rule to keep in mind is never to make only one signal at a time. And it is customary when stopped at a red light to blow one's horn loudly at the car ahead at the exact moment when, or preferably just before, the light changes from red to green. The driver who is first in line at the light expects this as a courtesy from the car behind. And an interesting conversation between an independent-minded lady driver and a motorcycle cop who asks to see her registration. Haven't got it, she says, and the cop says, how do I know this is your car? And she replies, how do I know that's your motorcycle? Also, the city motorist, who will be much comforted by Mr. Jennison's observations on how to treat pedestrians. Theoretically, of course, the pedestrian has no right on the road or intersection, whatever. You don't drive on his sidewalk, why should he walk on your road? In the chapter of the automobile and courtship, you will find a fitting explanation of what this phrase means. 700 yards ahead, squeeze left. And finally, instructions for driving a car onto a ferry after the ferry has left the dock. That's The Half-Open Road by Jennison, published by Doubleday, which gives me occasion to present some observations of my own about driving along Route 1 here in New England. Some observations I have set down in verse form. The title, Highway Fantasia. Along the low New Hampshire hills that fraternize with Maine, a highway takes the tourist out and brings him back again. These are the hills his fathers knew, the graves where his fathers lie. Though beauty is there, he is little aware. What does he seek and why? The poet Whittier's lonesome grave, announced by tonic and Burma shave, Coca-Cola and mild cigars grow in a dump of abandoned cars, a trailer camp, a greyhound bus, we fix flats abide with us, a new motel, a hot dog stand, one more skunk for the promised land, a Packard coupe, an underpass, a rotary meeting, Maine or Mass, Conshohocken, Silvertown, furnish the bride a dollar down, the Lord will come to redeem his own, a woman driver I might have known, a shivering Chevy, a Pontiac, baby carriage on the back, a measured mile, tea for two, Texas trailer, barbecue, US-1, 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 over and over the fond refrain, US-1 to Portland, Maine, 40, 50, 55, that man does it and he's alive, pity on the Pope, keep pass him, tank, coupe, pass him, bus, truck, pass him, a grove of birches, a lily pond, no, we're a mile and a half beyond, Beverly, Hampton, pass him, Kittery, Biddeford, pass him, you take in the country scene. I can't stop. The light's green. Pity on the pokey. US-1. Somewhere on a summer evening, the willow is a prayer, and weird is the call of the veery amid the silence there. Beyond a low New Hampshire hill, the sun in glory dies. A lonely pine tree has its will of whispering with the skies. That's all now. Until next week, goodbye, and read well. This is Leon Pearson.
You have been listening to the transcribed observations of NBC's critic at large, Leon Pearson. Mr. Pearson, who is at large in New England this week, has been heard through the facilities of station WBZ Boston. Be with us next week to hear Critic at Large.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
KSTP, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
By the French composer Maurice Ravel, as played by the Boston Pops Orchestra, conducted by Arthur Fiedler, in the fourth week of the regular spring series of pop concerts in Boston Symphony Hall. If you suffer from pains of headaches, neuritis, or neuralgia, you should discover what many thousands have known for years, that Anacin brings incredibly fast, effective relief. Anacin is like a doctor's prescription. That is, Anacin contains not just one, but a combination of medically proven active ingredients in easy-to-take tablet form. Probably at some time you've received an envelope containing Anacin tablets from your physician or dentist. Thousands of people have been introduced to Anacin this way. Try Anacin yourself the next time you suffer from the pains of a headache, neuritis, or neuralgia. You'll be delighted at how quickly relief can come. Anacin is spelled A-N-A-C-I-N. Your druggist has Anacin in handy boxes of 12 and 30 tablets and economical family-sized bottles of 50 and 100 for your medicine cabinet. Ask for Anacin today. A short piece of encore length is next as Arthur Fiedler conducts the Boston Pops in The Entrance of the Little Fawns, a March miniature by Gabriel Pierney.